Hello, and welcome to Real-Time Roots, a podcast about exploring the commonalities between many industries using real-time technology to share their stories with the world. Today's guest is Dan Pinchbeck, founder and creative director of The Chinese Room.
I believe wholeheartedly that as a creative director, it's less helpful to think of it as a leadership role and more helpful to think of it as a supporting role. Like, your job is to know the game better than anyone else.
The studio started its journey publishing survival horror mods before releasing Dear Esther in 2012, which published to critical acclaim. Since then, The Chinese Room have released Amnesia, Machine for Pigs, Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, and Little Orpheus. In this discussion, we talk about the creative process of working in video games, alongside discussing the role of a creative director and a team that's gone from a handful of developers releasing walking sims to a 120-person team working on two unannounced AAA projects. So without further ado, here's Dan. It'd be interesting to start on creative direction, because I heard in, I might have read this actually, an interview that you mentioned that I'm not very good at taking edicts from on high without going, yeah, but why? And I feel like that's almost like a founder. You almost need that mentality to start a studio, do it yourself, and just think, I'm just going to take this on and push through, even if you're not sure what you're doing. So I was wondering if you, I guess, still resonate with that mentality, if you feel like it was helpful in the early days of The Chinese Room, just where your perspective is on that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, on one hand, I think it is what everybody should expect of their creative director. Like, I really believe wholeheartedly that as a creative director, it's less helpful to think of it as a leadership role and more helpful to think of it as a supporting role. Like, your job is to know the game better than anyone else and to be able to answer any question that comes from anywhere in the team about any aspect of the game. And you shouldn't be like offended or affronted by asking those questions. You should always welcome them, because it's about honing it and about select people taking ownership of it. And if you find that question difficult to answer, then you need to go away and have a think about it, because maybe actually you haven't thought about it enough. So I think I always try and, it's something that we really try and work with in the studio. We talk a lot about having a culture of supportive critique, that anyone can ask anything, and that is valid. And it's really important to do that and to go outside your specialisms and your disciplines to ask those questions, because it helps against siloing. It helps against people that are so close that they can't see it themselves. And sometimes, you know, the idea that only a good design idea can come from design is kind of madness. So that goes for everything in terms of being that. And so as the creative director or the studio head, you're responsible for trying to maintain a culture of supportive critique, and one where the team feel empowered and they feel together and they feel like they all have that ownership. And that doesn't work if you are operating on a my way or the highway, I sit on high and hand down edicts kind of thing. So I think in the early days of TCR, because we weren't from within the games industry, there was definitely, you know, there was good and bad. There were places where we went, don't understand why you do it like that, because we wouldn't. And that meant that some of the stuff we did was really kind of like was fresh and was different and was new. And there are other places where sort of like, you know, 15 years later, I'm going, yeah, probably would have been a good idea if we'd have followed the received wisdom on that one. But I think you should never be just accepting that the received wisdom is wisdom just because it's packaged up that way. And I think anyone that is good at their job, is competent, is confident in their job, won't have a problem with being asked those questions and won't have a problem with their sort of like their structures being challenged, because you should be able to go, okay, well, there's a reason why we do it this way, and here it is, and here it is, and here it is. And I think if you are ever in a position where you're going, well, it just is because I'm the boss, I think you run the risk of not only missing on really wonderful things just happening around you because you only work with a model that must be predictable. You don't allow unpredictability into that model at all. But it also just strikes me as being a less interesting way of working. That I think one of the reasons why I love working in games is I love that collaboration, that holisticness, the fact that ideas are just flying around backs and forwards. So I kind of see it as being imperative that we do whatever we can to enable that, and that we shouldn't have a hard divide between creativity and business. In the same way, we should be going, well, the received wisdom is you can only sell this type of game at this time of year. And you're going, well, yeah, but we also know there's plenty of examples of games which have broken out in the most unlikely way without any of that market intelligence. So it's okay to question that. And the answer might be, well, we've looked at it and questioned it, and still we think it's a bad idea. But it just, I don't know, it just never seems sensible to me to just go, well, if I've been told that's how it is, that's how it should be. Because there's an awful lot in the world outside games that you know, has gone unquestioned for too long, and it's led us to a pretty bad place. So I think we need more questions, not less at this point.
Yeah, I really like that supportive critique phrase. Is that how you communicated internally to your team? Because I've always found a terrible way of communicating this, and I really like that phrase. I've always said that, you know, everyone contributes to the design. And although that is true, it's not necessarily clear boundaries. You know, if a programmer or animator contributes to design, it may conflict with a certain design philosophy or something like that. So you do need to have people that own individual areas. But how do you communicate that supportive critique internally, just on a day-to-day?
I think more respect comes from expertise than authority. I think if you have someone that's clearly an expert, clearly knows what they're doing, and oftentimes that is communicated through a confidence and a willingness to be critiqued and to enter into dialogue, then you're saying we're just putting the best ideas on the table. And usually people that have spent a long time kind of like learning a specialism, because they understand the intricacies of it. And particularly, I think cascading consequence is something that you only learn from either discipline. I know that sounds like a good idea, but I can tell you that actually 6 steps down the line, that will fall over. And I know that because I've spent 5, 10, 15 years doing this. But that's not presented as a, well, you can't contribute because it's my territory. It's presented as, okay, we'll all sit around and talk, but what I'll present to you is expertise. And usually I think that way you gain more respect. And it doesn't have to be a thing of people are shouting to be the loudest voice in the room, which is a really, really, really important thing to try and get to that point of saying, are the smaller, quieter, less confident voices, whom the ideas may be just as brilliant, getting the opportunity to contribute. But I think you do that more by basically saying, well, people are in positions of study leadership because they have expertise and because they're good at helping their teams get to somewhere. That isn't an authority which has to be protected. That's an authority which is earned through expertise and through a sort of like mutual respect. And I think partially all of these questions, there is a degree where you go into this knowing you're always going to fail, and the system needs constant tweaking, and it'll always fall over, and you'll always be leaking somewhere and plugging somewhere else. But I think if you go into it with that, with a sort of a genuine desire to try and make that system happen, then I believe in my heart, I mean, you know, it's obviously there are other sort of studios and work cultures that have radically different models and have produced amazing stuff. I personally believe that it's not just a way of making better games, but it's a way of making better games in a better environment, and doing so in a way that people come out at the end of the game making process in a better state.
And so on that process, it's at the start of the conversations, you're trying to communicate the ideas and saying, I can see where this, you know, falls over two or three points down the connection there. What about on trusting the process? Because I've heard you mention that you're talking about constantly saying, just trust me on this and it'll be right. And, you know, I can feel it, like this will work out in the end. How do you balance these two opposing forces sometimes in development?
I think that as a process works a lot better when there's sort of like 15 of you making a walking simulator than when there's 100 of you making a sort of a much more complex genre driven game. Because, you know, now we do have much more in terms of like pillars and documentation and things like that, because you're not always, as much as anything else, you're not always going to be there in the room to explain it. And also, I think one of the things which I've sort of like learned over the years is that you may think you're being really, really clear in your communication, and you know exactly what you told someone to do, and they've heard something completely different, not through any fault of their own, but maybe because, you know, you didn't describe it in a way which resonated with the way in which they understand the world. So I think I've definitely shifted more in that direction. I think where I suppose the old attitude stays with us, and I'm not sure it's even that unusual among sort of like studios, is that forgetting all the sort of academic theoretical stuff around agile and things like that, you are trying to keep enough space within the system of production of going, how do we keep the things that we can keep loose and reactive as late as we can? We know we've got to put some solid groundworks in. We know that, you know, if you don't get your engineering solid early on, you're going to be paying for it for the rest of the project. But how do we leave ourselves space to go, that isn't doing exactly what we thought it was going to do, or we think this could do better, or actually there is something which is potentially a bit more abstract we could chase over there. And that's, I think, gets harder and harder and harder as teams get bigger and bigger and bigger, because the project management side of it necessitates much more sort of data-driven, stronger structures where you go, we know what person X is going to be doing in 3 months' time, and we have to know that because that affects how we employ person A, B, C, and things like that. But I think you are also trying to go, you know, again, I suppose it goes back to it's the sort of resistance to the old fashioned kind of the bad old days kind of waterfall model where you write a GDD and say, this is what we're going to make. And 2 years later, you're still ticking boxes in that GDC. You made this horrible mess, because actually the reality of, you know, game development is that sort of like, what's the old thing that the no military plan survives contact with the enemy? There's an equivalent in game development where you go, that's fine until you start putting it in software, and then really all bets are off. And that's where you need, for me, that's where that sort of culture of expertise and respect comes in, because you need those people that can say, we've started on this process. I can already see we don't have to make the rest of it for me to be able to see we need to make these changes. And I can sit down and communicate those to you in a way that you can go, yes, I understand and see where you're coming from, and we can make those changes as we go. So I guess it's a bit like an oil tank. You know, it takes a 4 weeks to change direction, which means you've got to literally always have your hand on the steering wheel, because if you leave it until the point where you think you might need to change direction, it's far too late to do anything about it.
Are there any maybe either parallels or differences from when you move from academia into the games industry that you can draw parallels from, or there was processes in place where you were saying, we want to throw that stuff away, we just want to do it this way, and now coming full circle to a larger team again where you might have more studio processes in place, how has that process shifted for you over the years?
I mean, I think part of the reason why I came out of academia was I found it very straitjacketing. I found the pace very difficult. The notion of peer review, although it's so critically important to the way academia works, it felt so at odds with the kind of the way in which games were being made and how the kind of creativity that manifests in terms of sort of like, you know, whether it's games, whether it's art or anything else. That I think there was a sort of a point where there was this sort of 6 month or so process where I kept reading articles where theorists were saying games cannot do this, and then six games would come out which just challenged it and knocked it down. And that sort of explosion of as modern culture was morphing into sort of like indie culture in the sort of the around sort of like 2008 to 2013, 2014, it just felt like people were throwing out ideas. It was so unbelievably creative and sort of expansive in terms of what people were doing. But there was also a culture back then, you know, it was around sort of like when Steam had just sort of launched, where you could put quite mad stuff on Steam and it was flying and people were really buying into it. And people were very, like, gamers were incredibly risk-taking in terms of the types of games they'd just try out. And it didn't feel like games were so expensive. It was as much of a risk in terms of saying, well, I can spend a few bucks here or there and try this stuff out. So it just felt much more fertile as a space to go into, going, if you kind of are interested in exploring what games can be, the idea of not making games to do that just felt wrong, I suppose, wrong-headed. And then, I mean, in terms of how the studio developed, to an extent, if you do something relatively well in the games industry as a studio, you're going to be asked to do a version of that again. Because that's sort of kind of how the model works. You go, oh, you're good at that, do that again. That kind of makes sense. So I think when we made, after we'd finished making Rapture, and Rapture was really, I suppose, for me, was the end of a journey that began with Esther. With Esther, it was kind of, it really was a what if. What if you just had less, like, traditional mechanics, and will a story carry the experience by itself? Okay. And then Rapture was started from a very specific question of going, how could you tell a story in a game that you couldn't tell in a film? So could we do that? But could we do it in a non-linear space, which could only be realized as a game or using game technologies? And when that has sort of been answered in Rapture, I kind of felt a bit like, I'm not sure there's anything else to explore here. We could have carried on making walking simulators, I guess, but I kind of felt like we're a bit done there. And it also felt like the sort of culture around it that zeitgeist had kind of, that little bubble had come out. There's a point, I think, when Esther came out, when there was a lot of tension between story and mechanics, and it was like you did one or you did the other. And it wasn't just sort of like the indie or experimental titles like Esther, which were challenging that. It was stuff like Dead Space and Uncharted, which were going, well, we can really start using story to really hook the player in. And then about 5 years later, I suppose sort of after around about the time that we'd made Rapture, it just didn't feel like there was any point in walking simulators existing as a separate genre in that way, because story had been pushed so far up the agenda for so many games production. And it becomes so much more sophisticated. Like some of the stuff that we were saying, hey, well, look, why don't you try doing this and this and this? Actually, a lot of games were then just doing that as standard, as part of their process. So I suppose that kind of moves us on as a studio as well, in terms of going, well, okay, it's time to sort of like do that. And I think there was always an aspiration to go, can we keep all that world building, all that storytelling, all that emphasis on kind of like the player's emotional experience? It's been proved over and over and over and over and over again that there is absolutely no, I think now you'd kind of probably be laughed at if you said you can't have story and gameplay in the same space. Go and talk to Arkane. They might have an opinion on that. So moving the studio towards sort of doing something of going, well, can we take that sort of like expertise that we developed and like now move into stuff which is more sort of, I suppose, traditional genre. And that's kind of exciting, I suppose. It's just sort of, it's, I suppose for me, I don't ever want to be making the same thing over and over again, because, you know, I'm pushing 50. I'd like to do as many different things as I can, you know, during my career. I find it feels like it's a more interesting thing to do.
How much do you feel that games like Esther or Gone Home around that time inspired these kind of AAA studios? Because you can kind of see the creative direction of these titles, especially like a Naughty Dog style game, where you almost see those influences from the walking simmy. They appreciate they need tight gameplay feedback loops and things like this, but they also created a lot of space for this storytelling that you could see mirrored in these walking sim titles. So I feel like they were almost needed to push those larger projects forward.
I think it's a really interesting one, because one of the most influential games on me in sort of the entire time I was playing was Soul Reaver, which was Amy Hennig, who was creative director on Uncharted. So a hugely influencing game on Dear Esther was created by the creative director and lead designer of Uncharted, that were pushing that sort of stuff in AAA about the same time Dear Esther was there. So I'm always a little bit wary of kind of going, yes, we inspired this or this sort of thing. I think there was a zeitgeist. And I think Esther particularly, because of the randomization and because of the sort of cut and pasty sort of kind of like way in which the story itself was probably out on an extreme edge of that. But I do think it was a wave, and I think it would be probably presumptuous and more than a little arrogant to say walking simulators showed the way for AAA. I think if anything, what they might have done is provided a means for the sort of people who really cared about narrative and story within those big projects to say, look, it's worth investing in this stuff, because they're doing nothing but this stuff over there. And that's going down really, really well. So it kind of almost provided, I suspect, maybe some additional leverage for people that already thought that way and cared that way within AAA. And I think around the time, again, of that indie explosion, you know, there was sort of like a, in places you could sort of like feel a bit of a tendency to go, yes, the AAA sluggish dinosaurs making the stuff over there, and we're the sort of like, you know, the fast moving indie sort of things over here. And it never really felt like it was particularly honest or fair, because actually most of the reason why we were indies in the first place is because we'd grown up playing their games and have been inspired by things that were in those games. And it was more about, I suppose, with Esther going, the way in which the sort of like the sort of economies of production and all that sort of stuff, it's going to be incredibly difficult for a large scale title to be as specific in this direction in an unproven place in the market as this. But that's what small game companies, they can sort of like, they can do that. So it was kind of, I suppose, more a thing of going, it feels like there is a really interesting design space operating kind of outside the main sort of like path of the Searchlight's beam. And it feels pretty unlikely that anyone's going to go into that space if they're commercially motivated, because it's just so risky and so unproven. And I think it helped that Esther started off as a mod, because we already kind of knew there was an audience. We knew people reacted to it. I think if we'd have gone out and said, hey, we've got this great idea, could we have sort of like, you know, $500,000 to make this thing? Probably, imagine most publishers would be pretty reticent. But being able to go in with that mod thing of going, well, we already know with sort of like very, very limited Half-Life 2 graphics and a, you know, a kind of a digital score and all this sort of stuff. We've already got sort of like a couple of 100,000 people playing this and talking about this and really responding to it. It doesn't feel like as much of a risk to now try and commercialize that and sort of like push its quality up. And I think a lot of that also comes down to, you know, we talk a lot about the invention, the creativity and all this sort of stuff. A great deal of it also comes down to Steam. If Steam hadn't launched in that window, none of this stuff happens. So I think we have to be also quite humble as creators as well of going, you know, you can, it's not just about this sort of like anarchic punk kind of like system of production. We were heavily reliant on one of the biggest software companies in the business, creating a platform and putting people on that platform, putting people on the front page of that platform that was sort of like, you know, more sort of high risk games. So yeah, I think it's really important to sort of, to understand the cross-fertilization between big and small business in terms of that type of game making, I think.
And when you're talking about the delivery mechanisms of these storytelling approaches, you mentioned Esther having more cut and paste approach. What are you currently thinking about storytelling wise and how to engage the player? I know you've kind of got some more cinematic type delivery in your recent title. And I know you're also potentially writing a novel in a more linear medium. So how are you thinking about your writing craft at the moment?
I think in a weird kind of way, it always boils down to the same thing, which is you fundamentally want to tell a good story well. And all of this process sort of came initially from sort of me doing this PhD on story as a gameplay mechanic, which was like weirdly hotly contentious at the time. And I was like, it's ridiculous, it's contentious. It's the same as ballistics or AI or graphical fidelity. You create emotional experience, you plug the player into the middle of it, and there's this kind of contract between the player and the system, and everyone tries to have a good time. And story is one of the things you can bring to bear on that experience to create a kind of an architecture for the players to do their stuff in. So it's tools that you use, and you use the right tools to achieve what you want to achieve. I think it's been a long time since people have been talking about sort of like really heavily interactive, directly adaptive storytelling in games. And I think it hasn't really emerged in the way that sort of stuff like, what was it called? It's called Facade by Michael Mateus and Andrew Stern. And it's basically just like an interactive drama where you go into someone's flat and it's a couple and they're breaking up, but it's like super reactive to what you do. Only it's not, but it was used as a real totem for interactive storytelling and interactive drama for a long time. Very, very sort of dynamic choice driven, interactive, complex interactive narratives where they're very, very reactive to the player. They can switch and move things around all the time. So no matter what you do, the system can cope with it and blah, blah, blah. And sort of, I suppose, stuff like kind of like Detroit and things like that get a bit closer to that. But they're still fundamentally authored experiences. And I think players want an authored experience, largely. Or you want to be a pure creative. It's a very uncomfortable middle ground to be going, you can be really creative, you can tell your own story, but we're going to sort of somehow hold you responsible for the quality of that story. Or we're going to then try and make you do these things in here. Like years and years and years ago, so a friend of ours was doing some working in interactive cinema, really early days of interactive cinema. I remember they're having a conversation with Jessica, and they said, but it'd be great, you can go and see a film and you'll be able to choose the ending of the film. And she just went, why would I want to do that? What I really want to do is go and see a film that someone spent years and years and years honing, and then they give me the best possible ending for that film, and I walk away happy. And it was a really interesting conversation. And I think it's a similar sort of thing with games and storytelling of going, the contract with the player fundamentally is, if you trust us and you play this the way we want you to play it, we will give you a good time. And that's really basically what is going on with games. You're going to give us some money and we're going to give you this thing. And there's a few rules about how you can interact with this thing. And if you interact with it in those rules the way we set, you're going to come out of this and you'll feel really, really happy that you spent time in the system. And that's really it. It's not any more complex than that. So for me, story is part of that. So I would prefer to play a game with a completely non-interactive story that's delivered through cinematics if need be, although I do get frustrated about the length of them sometimes, than something which goes, you can do anything you want, it's hugely interactive story and this kind of stuff, but it just feels like this sort of soggy mess. I don't feel like I've kind of really had an authored experience in that way. So in terms of for what we're doing, I think it's still finding that sort of stuff of going, what is the right blend for the project that you're working on? What is it the story has to achieve here? And so what are the tools that you bring to bear on that to try and make that work? I think always trying to be aware of going, one of the things that story does more than anything else is create context for action. It's one of its most powerful uses in games. I do this because, and if as a player, I have to understand I'm doing something for some abstract reason, I'm pressing the blue button because the blue button links to the green triangle and the green triangle links to the red square and the red square links to the note E flat. And it's really, really hard. But if you say you press the green button, that opens the bay doors and the shuttle comes out and you save the dignitaries, it's much easier to chain that logic in your head and to remember it because you tell that story to yourself. So gameplay should always be storified in that way because it should exist within context. And that's kind of like, you know, game design 101 now. But it doesn't mean to say that you should be going, you kind of also need to be making decisions about going, what is the contract we have with the player here? If the contract with the player is, you will 75% of this, you will watch, which I suppose is kind of not quite to that extreme, but you know, sort of Supermassive do this unbelievably well. This is an interactive movie. So consider that. Don't expect it to be this because it's that. And they're very, very good at communicating that, very clear and very good at delivering on it. It doesn't mean to say it's a better or worse story than Doom or Borderlands. It's just they understand story as a gameplay mechanic and they bring to bear the right amount of story and deliver it in the right way for it to for the player experience to make sense. So I don't see any difference between that and Dear Esther in that case. I see no difference between, I don't know, Doom and Dear Esther. I mean, I'm a huge Doom fan anyway, but they're the same thing. They just go, what are the tools that we bring to bear on the player experience in order to make sure that that contract we have with the player is delivered fairly and everyone has a good time as a result of it? And I think for us, the studio, we'll never not be kind of obsessive about story because I'm obsessive about story and you know kind of it's a lot of it kind of like runs from me going I think we should do this and convincing everybody that's what we should do, but I don't think it means that we will always do the same thing in the same way because it's not always going to be appropriate to do the same thing in the same way. I suppose
on the more I guess emergent storytelling side of things, I heard you say a really interesting I guess phrase that I just wanted to read back and just hear you reflect on it a little bit. It was that we want the players to parachute in and start telling the story themselves. There's no tool as powerful as the player's imagination. And then you go on to say that it's co-authorship, a collaboration between you and what you produce and what the player does when they're willing to tell the story themselves. So you can constrain the physical space, but you can't contain the emotional space. You can't tell them how to feel. Just reflecting on that, how much of a light touch do you need in certain areas of your storytelling? There's like the kind of critical path storytelling that you just want them to go away with, I definitely know this about the game. And then there's the kind of softer delivery mechanisms, either through environmental storytelling or whatever devices you use. How do you think about that push and pull between the different approaches?
I suppose the first thing is, I genuinely believe there's nothing you can put on a screen that's going to be as powerful as what the player can kind of draw and paint and hear in their own head. So if you fill in all the blank spaces, you're denying the player the opportunity to dream into that space and to take it away from them and own it. So I think because we're a visual medium, but unlike film, we can't select camera pointing and stuff like that a lot of the time. We do have to fill in more of those blank spaces because we have to deal with the fact that a player could be doing many more things and looking at many more things. So we're kind of already constrained in terms of going, we can't suggest things with a vista as well as film can. We can't have a player, have a character see something off screen that we can't also see very well. So we have to be quite careful and deft because a lot of those techniques of mystery and ambiguity that other mediums use to create that space of imagination, we can't have because of the nature of interactivity and how players are in there. On the flip side, what we can do that no one else can do is we can put a player directly in the center of a story, and they can stand in the middle of a story and walk around and look at it and engage with it. And no other medium can do that. So it's understanding that you know, there are strengths and weaknesses with it, and playing to those strengths and weaknesses rather than just trying to apply other models of story directly top down onto it. If you try and put a movie script down in a game, it'll be terrible. Because at some point you have to go, we have to handle exposition because we have to handle player instruction. How do you do that? And then, you know, we've all played those games. I think the biggest thing for me, though, is it's about leaving the player emotional interpretive space. So I'm not a big fan of morality bars, for example, where I don't want a player to interpret my feelings. A game to interpret my feelings back to me. So say something like I love Mass Effect. I'm a huge fan of the series. But it really, sometimes it's going to fall over places where you'll say, it'll give you an option to react, and you'll say, I react in this way. I'll say, aha, so you think this. And you think, no, I don't think that or feel that, but that's the only option you gave me. So I think you have to try and be really careful as a game writer to go, the player's emotional palette will be much more sophisticated than you can represent in the system. So don't try and reduce the player's palette to what you can fit in the system. Try and introduce enough ambiguity in the system that it allows for different sort of like interpretations to come through. And like one of the ways that we've talked about recently in terms of doing that, in terms of stuff like, say, interactive dialogue systems, is don't treat story as a problem to be solved. And a really, really good example of this is, again, an otherwise brilliant game. I love the Deus Ex Human Revolution, the first reboot. I prefer it to Mankind Divided. I think it's just a stunning, stunning game. But they have those dialogue fights. And the problem with the dialogue fights is that you're never engaging with the character, and you're never engaging emotionally. You're just trying to figure out which option will give you the gameplay credit, if you like, to go forwards. And so for me, that's a real fail in terms of game writing, because what you've done is you've said, you're in interior space, imagination to play, it means nothing. This is just throwing darts at a board and hoping you get the right one. And more sophisticated games, and I think, again, Mass Effect does this very, very, very well, probably 75-80% of the time, is it says, those choices you're making, they don't actually mean very much in terms of gameplay, but they give you more space to kind of go, I feel like this about this person and stuff like it. And it sort of culminates to me in the not the actual end of Mass Effect 3, but the bit just before the end of Mass Effect 3, which was some of the best game writing I think ever, which is when all you do is walk down a corridor and say goodbye to the characters that you built up a relationship with over 100 hours of play. And you know, when you walk through that door, every single one of those characters is going to die. No one's going to survive this. And it's really powerful and emotional, because it does, no one says, none of us are going to survive this. You just go, it's been fun, it's been great, I'll see you on the other side. And you know that Shepard is lying, and the other character, they're lying to each other because they all know they're all going to die. But the game never says they're lying to each other. It lets you know that. It gives your imagination space to hold that thought and that emotion. And that, to me, is brilliant game writing. It sort of allows ambiguity in and lets you go, you can interpret what's going on here your way. And that's more powerful than choices and branches, because it's letting the player in. It's not just saying to a player, you will be judged. There's a guy, like really, really early on, before I got into games, there's a theorist called Espen Arseth, who was then a professor at, I think, IT University in Copenhagen. And he wrote a really early book on interactive narrative. And one of the things which he said in it, which always stuck with me, which was brilliant, he said, interactive narrative is not additive. You don't give the players choices. You remind the player that they will never see a piece of content when they make a choice. If you offer the player left and right branches and they choose left, what you're actually saying to them, you will never know what was on the right-hand branch. And you have to think about it like that, or you're going to create a system which is just about people who come to that branch and they'll sit there stressed and trying to work out what the best choice is. What they won't do is flow naturally through and go, I'm following my emotional arc, which would lead me to intuitively choose this response. And then I want a response back from that that allows space for my intuitive response to be something which I own. And that's, in a way, it's difficult, but it's sort of writing in a more classic writing way. So it's trying to bring in some of those kind of things from non-game writing of going, you'd never have a character in a novel. If someone said, I'm not sure what we should do next. I mean, we've got two options. We could head towards the sea, or we could head towards the mountain. No one in a novel goes, well, if you head towards the mountain, you have to be aware there will be more treasure chests, but also a few more dragons. The sea, on the other hand, feels great, but don't remember. And it's just, it's not there. But there's no reason for it to be there in a game either. And we're talking about a medium, which is now, what, half a century old? pretty much in terms of home computing. I mean, I got my first Atari in like the late 70s, so it's been going on a long time. Players are pretty sophisticated. They know the genres are there, the media schema intelligence is there. You don't need to tell a player how a game story is going to unfold, which means if you're doing that, you're denying them the opportunity to be at the center of their own story. So for me, that is the more, when we're talking about parachuting in story and player sort of like being in control of the story, it's less about them being able to define absolutes and branches, and it's more about paying them the respect of going, they're as smart as you, they're as imaginative as you, and they're as invested in this world as you are. So give them the space and the respect to sort of to do that.
Yeah, it's that tough balance, isn't it? Because you want, especially when you're creating stories, you're saying something in the game and just like, oh, they've not pressed a button input for a little while. So do we need a button input here? Like, okay, press X to do thing. And it's that really difficult balance of where to tell the story, when to tell the story. And as you're saying that about dialogue as well, it reminds me of a game called Oxenfree that uses more like dialogue verbs as the communication. So it's what action do you want to create, and not necessarily about the line that you're about to say. And that feels a bit more freeing as well, I think.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah, I think so. And again, it's tools. I mean, the other sort of, in terms of story, people that I always kind of come back to as well is like Ninja Theory. And Ninja Theory it's not sophisticated in terms of its structure in the way they're telling stories. They just really understand how to tell a good story really bloody well. And they understand that it's not as simple as the kind of, was it David Cage who said more pixels, more emotion? It's not that simple. But they do understand that it's also a visual language in terms of game storytelling. And I think the first time I really remember them doing this was in Enslaved Journey to the West, where there's a scene, I think, where they tell Pigsy that Tripp's dad, who is his friend, died. And literally all they do is just like part of his face, he just sags slightly on his cheek, and you go, and you're there instantly. It's all you need, a tiny little ambiguous cue. So it's often not about big picture stuff. It's about just going, I understand that if we just do this little thing, that creates this space of possibilities. And I think like Oxenfree's verbs as well, of going, I don't need a detailed response to this. I need to know a broad direction that I can then sort of fill in the blanks from. And then it feels like me as a player, as a gamer, I'm as invested in it. And I think that's where stories become much more sophisticated. And that's where the sort of the old sort of tradition of like, well, when I'm playing gameplay, I'm doing everything. But when the story pops up, I'm literally thrown out of the world and thrown away from the system. And I'm not allowed to be part of that process. And then I'm called back in again. And I think more sort of contemporary, modern game storytelling, where it is far more sophisticated, is going, even if you do switch to a cinematic, you should have an unbroken flow of investment in the story that doesn't change whether you're directly interacting with the feedback mechanic or not. Your engagement with the story and your sort of relationship with the story doesn't change. And that is, I think, the sort of the art of it, really.
When we're thinking about how to tell the next story or the delivery of the mechanics, I like to phrase it as each game being a reaction to the last title that we made. So it's almost like all the things that we feel like we didn't do right, we want to really try and engage with it. And maybe it goes back to your genre typecasting point that you made making before, where it's just like, we've done this genre, we don't need to do it again. We want fresh challenges. So as you're moving forward and you're thinking about the titles that you're working on, I guess, how much does genre play a part in that, and thinking about what things you want to tackle?
I mean, I suppose it's tricky in a way, because it's kind of like, it is still the games industry, and you're still sort of responding to, we are a business and we have to produce things that, while we're striving to make things which are excellent and we'd love to be making works of art, we have overheads and we have to do things and we have to make sure that we're sort of, and there is a tension there, which I think can be really, really exciting. It's not necessarily a bad thing. So I don't think there is this free reign of going, we want to make this, so we're going to make this. You do have to go things and go, well, look, we've got sort of like, you know, sort of 100 people sitting up there. And if we decide we're going to make something that is so ridiculously high risk, we've got to also be considering the economics of that. But I think in terms of, there's always an interesting story to tell. I suppose for me, as a writer, the opportunity to create a world and to tell a story into a space is amazing. It's really, really, really exciting. And if you pointed me at pretty much any genre of game, I'd go, cool, great, and I can make a story in that. And that's the challenge. And the constraints aren't problems. The constraints are what makes it wonderful. So I don't ever feel there's this kind of thing of going, oh no, you know, someone's, you know, asked us to make an RTS game. And we're like, I don't know. There's great stories told in RTS games. It's great stories told in FPS games, whatever, RPGs, whatever it is. There's always great stories. The story is not genre constrained in that way. What I think is most interesting and the thing to try and you're trying to do as a writer is go, looking at, say, these games, say, looking at FPS games, going, most FPS games have these types of characters and these kind of stories and sort of works in this way. And it goes back to the first thing we talked about. Well, why is that? Is that because actually they have to be these types of characters and this type of story? Or is that just because the way it's always been done because it's been successful, so people just keep doing it? And the answer is probably somewhere in between, and it's a mix of elements there. But that's why you should be asking that question. I keep talking about Wolfenstein this week. I love Wolfenstein. I love the Machine Games versions of it. Just outstanding games. In the first reboot, it's a completely, on paper, by the numbers, FPS story. And they just honed it and refined it. But you play it, and about halfway through, you go, I really, really care about all of these characters. I love these characters. They really mean something to me. And they did that because they went, why can't these characters be rounded? Why can't these characters have depth? There's no reason why they just have to be one-dimensional. And they just, I think they found them. And they also set the world. And this is, I think, for me, it is the core of how I approach stories and I hope we approach stories as a studio, which is, you go back to something like the TV show, The Detectorists. And The Detectorists is Toby Jones and Mackenzie Crook standing in a field for half an hour with a metal detector talking shit. And you just love them. And you'd watch them do anything because you love those characters. And I really genuinely firmly believe in games. Our job is very, very similar. We set this world, we understand this context, but then fundamentally what we're doing is we're putting characters in there that you care about and you want to spend time with. And if you feel like you would play the game with that character, but you're just as happily go to the pub with that character or watch TV with that character or go for a walk with that character, you just want to be with that character, your story will fall from that. It will emerge from that because fundamentally it'll be the emotional connection is there. And I think that's why Rapture worked. I think not because it was the most innovative, greatest story ever told in the game, not because it was massively non-linear and all this sort of stuff. It worked because people, the characters resonated with people and they cared about what happened to them. And because of that, it didn't need to have a lot of mechanics and stuff because you already were invested in that way. So that to me is always, you know, it's still always the fundamental of going, make a world which people want to be in and populate it with people that players care about. And if you can tick those boxes, you can apply that to any genre.
And in your leadership role building a studio, how are you onboarding people into the studio's culture from that perspective? Because it could be, you know, varying genres and things like that, but you can understand why it's easy for certain studios to become very good at a certain genre because there's the whole aspect of game development where you just need the tech and the tools and all this kind of thing. So how do you develop that flexibility so you're not just working in one direction and people are very kind of, yeah, able to move across genres very easily?
I mean, I don't want to sort of like position us as being radically different from a lot of other studios. You know, in many ways, we're not. We're still looking for Unreal programmers who have experience in this type of mechanic or that type of mechanic. And the sort of the titles that we're working on are not so dissimilar to each other that there isn't. Like Orpheus was a big step out. I mean, we'd never done a sort of 2.5D platformer and it was a brand new team. And I don't know that we'd have made it differently. And it came out of the left field. It felt like a great opportunity and we did it. But we had to reskill a lot of stuff. And that's not, you're not going to do that from game to game necessarily in the same way. I mean, I think in terms of when we're bringing people on board, on one level, we're very lucky in that we've been around for long enough and we've made some games that people like, particularly young developers like, that seem to really appeal to them. So quite a lot of people come to us because they're really interested in story and they really like the idea of games being very, very sort of emotional. And I think so that helps in that sort of way. And I think the way in which we've always talked about working culture and what we try, and we've always been very open in terms of what we try and achieve with the working culture. Sumo have a very good reputation for looking after their people and for having a very supportive working culture. That also helps us. So people come to the door with expectations, and it's our job to meet those expectations. And I think that's good because it challenges us as well to go, are you delivering that studio culture you promised? But I think it's also about studios aren't, again, I don't believe, and there are other studios which operate in different ways and other companies that operate in different ways. Personally, for me, I don't believe that the brand is more important than the people that make that brand. If you, and we know we went through this when we shuttered the studio and then we rebuilt it under studio, it was a different studio. The Chinese Room up to 2018 is not the Chinese Room from 2018 forwards. It can't be. It's fundamentally, you know, there are fundamental differences in it. And the challenge was to preserve what really felt like it should be carried on from that, but also to recognize parts of that didn't, you know. But I think you are, a studio is made up of its people. And particularly you're trying to have those people that sort of like towards the, in those kind of positions of trust and leadership and expertise in there, who bring their team with them, who sort of shepherd and nurture their teams. And their major responsibility is not keeping people in line. It's helping a team come together and helping all those people understand the contributions they can make and where they can be at their best and wanting to give their sort of best. And I think those are the sort of, it's that attitudinal thing, which is really, really, really important, because you can, you're always going to need like really sort of like people that are absolutely kind of total experts in one thing. You know, there's, you know, aspects of development that are so complicated and so specific. You've got to have people that just go, I can, what do you do? Well, I make parachutes, but I'm the best parachute maker in the world. And there's always the need for those kind of roles. But you should also have a studio which says, even to those people, you're really, really good at making parachutes. You've been making parachutes for 25 years now. Do you want to try something else? Because it might be that they're even better at making tables and you just haven't seen it because you've had them locked into parachutes. So you've got to try and keep that flexibility. And for me, that's what really, really good management is, understanding that it's an active relationship where you are not just saying, I employed this person to do this job, but you're saying, if I've employed this person, part of my responsibility is to be constantly watching that person and seeing how they're developing and understanding that their development may be inspired by or changed by things which have nothing to do with their work life, nothing to do with the studio, just maybe an interest. They go, they do an art class, they start being interested in painting. Suddenly they start doing that and you go, hang on, we've got an artist over here. We thought they were a programmer. That's your job, to be sort of understanding that and seeing that. And I think if you see your people as your people, not as sort of like employee ... then I don't know, I might be wrong, it's a personal thing, but it strikes me that that's how you make a better studio and a better place to work, and you probably make better games as a result.
Are there any things that come to mind when you go from say 6 to 12 to 15 to 30 people and then, you know, 40 plus and onwards? I know earlier on at the Chinese Room, you had the, I guess, cultural philosophy of giving people the space, give them the creative input, let them manage themselves. And I kind of have a push and pull relationship with that as well, because in the early days, everyone's just kind of bootstrapping and pushing together, trying to drive the thing forward. But as you grow, you have to put a few more pipelines and processes in place, and that necessarily some things do need to shift. So does anything come to mind for you across that journey that you've kind of changed your thinking?
I mean, without doubt, we have, I mean, some of the most important people we have in the studio is like project management and production, in terms of actually going, you have to be answering the question of going, particularly if you're working with an external, and even more if you're not, if you're running off your own bank account, then double so, of going, can we get to the end point where we need to get to the end point? Are our aspirations right? Have we scoped this thing properly? The answer to that is always no, you haven't scoped it properly, and you have to rescope it at least 30 times along the process. But that's just software development. So when there's a small number of you, you can be more fluid, you can be more adaptable, because you can see the edges of everything. The game's smaller, for starters. It just is. It's not as complex. It's a smaller title. You can see it all at once. There's no way when you're up to sort of 30 people, you can't see all the game at once. And the systems are more complex. The aspirations. You know, you've gone from maybe working in sort of like a relatively low level in Unity up to sort of going, we're in Unreal. And suddenly, the moment you're 30 people, you have to be 30 people and 300 people, because there's no difference visually between a AA and a AAA game within Unreal. The bar is so high. So you're having to kind of chase all these complex systems. It's not possible to do that in a piecemeal way. You have to have pipelines. You have to be driven off data. You have to be tracking. When you say, I've done 5 hours work, have you done 5 hours work? Have you done 2.5, whatever it is? And that's not just about making sure you can deliver the game. That's also about protecting your team. That's also about saying, are we asking a reasonable thing of our people to deliver? Because that's critically important as well, because we're all trying to avoid sort of like crunch and overtime and stuff like that as much as we possibly can. We're all trying to make sure that someone isn't feeling overwhelmed or overburdened because they've been asked to produce X, Y, and Z, and it's just really impossible for them to do so. We have to be able to identify team members that are, say, struggling or are in slightly the wrong job, and all those things need data. And that means you're into project management and you're into proper project management, formal systems, and there's no way around that. And I resisted that for a very, very long time when we were smaller, because I didn't think we needed to. And I still stand by a lot of that resistance at that scale. It would be disaster at this scale. It's just there's no way around it. The flip side is that the tail cannot be allowed to wag the dog. And I think what you have to be constantly vigilant about is that if you're working with whatever the system is, where you're assigning tasks and things like that, you don't get into a tick box mentality where you're saying, I've got 30 tasks and I work my way down the task list, and those tasks exist in isolation and no one's coming out to the bigger picture and thinking about the context. And that's the mirror of that sort of data-driven project management approach, is you have to be really, really vigilant that you don't lose sight of the game, that it doesn't become an exercise in project management and in project delivery, and everyone understands this is why we're doing these things and this is the game we're making. And that's also, I think, really, really important for the team, because making games is really, really, really hard. It's much harder than a lot of other parts of software development. So you should be engaged with it. You should be wanting to make what you can make. And it's really important that a team can go, that's why we're putting this effort in. We can see this and we're making something brilliant and creative here. We're making a piece of, you know, a wonderful story and a wonderful game. It's not just a piece of software that's a series of boxes to tick. So yeah, again, push pull, I think, similarly to you, of going, it's critically important, and it's not just something which you have to do under sufferance. You're doing it because it's the right thing to do for your team as well as the project. But it's also sort of like keeping aware of it, of going, fundamentally, you're not doing painting by numbers. You're trying to create something fresh and different.
And you mentioned you've had a few conversations about Wolfenstein just this week, but yes. Is there any recent project that's inspiring your work at the moment? It doesn't have to be video game related, but anything that's kind of on front of mind there?
I think we're still sort of like, still in that sort of like weird kind of place where we're sort of both in and out of the pandemic and nowhere near as out of it as we're being told we are, particularly if you are sort of like either clinically vulnerable or sort of like living with a related someone who's clinically vulnerable. I think for the moment, actually, one of the big things for me has been being outside. So Jess and I went to Spain recently and found ourselves in the middle of kind of like a 5th century Iberian archaeological site. And I'm a big archaeology nerd anyway. Being connected to the world, I think, is a big thing right now in terms of just feeling like reconnecting with that. Years and years ago, we interviewed a VFX artist who James Watt, who did the VFX on Rapture. And when we were talking to him, we were like, are there any games that particularly inspire in terms of graphics? And he just pointed out the window and went, why are you looking at games to be inspired? And it's always stayed with me of going, yeah, get out into the world. That's where it is. So I think at the moment, getting back into museums, art galleries, standing with your feet on the ground, breathing the air, going, this is where we exist. And I think bringing that back into games at the moment for me feels like the thing which the sort of ideas which are gently being worked on in the background is definitely kind of, and in a way that's kind of full circle. It's going back to where it was with sort of stuff like Esther and Rapture, going, this is sort of, you know, I guess kind of psycho geography kind of real world. How do you translate that kind of storytelling?
And when you're not outside exploring, is there any books or articles that you're reading that you think would be worth highlighting for people? It could be fiction, non-fiction. I know Carl Sagan is a big hero of yours.
Yeah.
Point out there, maybe.
I was thinking about this actually. So the book which I think that everybody, literally everybody in the world should read, is a book called Humankind by Rutger Bregman. And his thesis is going, we've been pumped full of this idea of kind of like that we are competitive, violent, aggressive, selfish things. And he says it's complete rubbish. And actually a lot of the stuff which has been taught to us, like the mill dam experiment, all that sort of stuff, it's rubbish. It's all bullshit. And actually, this is what we're like. As a species, we are actually inherently social and kind, and we look after each other and altruistic. And it's a really beautiful, optimistic book. It doesn't pull punches. It's quite hard in some places. But I read it about 6 months ago at the end of a really, really, really tough couple of years. And it just kind of went back in and went, people are pretty good, actually. Not all of them. Not the ones in power, unfortunately. But most people, they're pretty good, actually. Give each other a break. Give yourself a break. And it's a really, I think, a book I'd just recommend to everyone in terms of if your faith in human nature is at a low ebb, it really picks it back up again. And it does have an impact on design stuff because you are thinking about putting something positive back into the world and stuff like that. And the other book, which I think is amazing, which I read recently, is there's a wonderful book by Rebecca Ragg-Sykes called Kindred, which is all about Neanderthals and just how the kind of like the image of the kind of the caveman species that went extinct has just completely evaporated, and that they were just as cultured and just as smart and just as emotionally rich and everything as us. And again, in combination, those two books, it's so completely humbling of going, it's really probably a bit of genetics and a bit of climate change and a bit of ecology and a bit of the fact that we're all carrying quite a lot more Neanderthal DNA than we know about it. But things do go in different directions sometimes. You're not in control of it. It's just a really, I don't know, again, very, very life-affirming book of kind of going, the odds are pretty small that we're here at all, even smaller that I'm here, even smaller that you and I are here, even smaller that you and I are here having this conversation. So sort of like trying to make the most of life. And I think that at the moment is, yeah. I think, again, with games always being very hard to make, and they'd be very, very sort of like bunkering and very sort of tunnel visiony, and you get very involved in it. Anything you can be doing to sort of like step outside that and go, the whole world's out here, and actually that's amazing. I love doing it and this sort of stuff. Fundamentally, it's a job. Fundamentally, life is here and it's different. And kind of that perspective, I think, is hugely important.
That's perfect, because I've not heard of either of those, so I'll definitely check those out. And I'll intentionally leave this open-ended, but is there currently anything that's exciting you?
At the moment, we are, in terms of where we are at the projects, I'm excited by the prospect of human boxes getting ticked and we can go, great, brilliant, fantastic, we can see the ends in sight. I think, like I say, at this point, it's just kind of, it feels like for us as a studio, we changed a lot very, very quickly, and we changed a lot and grew a lot during the pandemic. We went from 30 people to 120 people during the pandemic. It's lovely starting to see people again. People starting to come in, seeing people's kind of being back in a studio and feeling that sort of life and energy around you. I'm really, really responding to. So I think for the most part, it's less about sort of like specific pieces of media and stuff like that at the moment, and more about going, there's a really amazing, inspiring process and a lovely, amazing bunch of people to work with here, and sort of like feeling like back in that again is really wonderful and inspiring.
And it sounds like connecting with your team might be one of these, but do you have anything currently in your day that helps you stay either physically or mentally healthy that you'd recommend people look into?
Yeah, I mean, I tend very strongly towards burnout. I'm pretty bad at actually managing that sort of stuff. Historically, I've always been quite poor at reading the warning signs that I'm overdoing it. I think structure is really, really important. I try and be really structured around stuff, understanding that working long hours is not more productive often. And actually, you probably get more out of a day if you work 10 till 4 than if you work 10 till 10. So I think I sort of really try and sort of like be mindful about stuff, leaving gaps. One thing actually I would say, more than anything else, which is the habit that we've all got into during the pandemic, is multitasking, because you are on one Zoom call or one Teams call. You're also checking your emails. You're also in at least three or four Teams conversations or Zoom conversations on the other side of it. And what it actually means is that you're doing a job and a half or two jobs for every day of the job you do. And there's no way we could make games under that normally. And I think it's going to be really, really interesting as we go back to work and you sit in a meeting and you go, well, I'm in this meeting. And then you realize you're slipping behind and you go, I'm not slipping behind. I'm now doing a reasonable day's work But because I'm not multitasking, it feels like actually I'm slipping down behind it, because I'm not actually doing three things at the same time. And it's so profoundly unhealthy. And I think it's something that a lot of us drifted into during the pandemic, because you sort of just did, because you're at home and things like that. So for me, it's about also trying to come back to that thing of going, remembering what a day's work actually should contain, and that the day's work, the sort of pandemic day's work, is very artificial and isn't really sort of like right. And actually sort of doing less in a day as we used to, but doing it in a more focused way, is not only, again, better for the project, but in terms of emotional and mental well-being. Otherwise, we're just burning too far all the time, too fast. And it's trying to sort of like recapture that thing of going, how many things do you want to achieve in a day? Because if it's over a certain number, then that's just impossible. And it's certainly not sustainable.
Right, well, thank you for your time today, Dan. It was really, really good talk. And I think a lot of people will find your talks online if they go and search your name. There's so much good advice out there, and whether it be on creativity or the process of making games, there's a lot of great content out there. And also just for creating the games that you make, because our studio definitely wouldn't exist without work like yourselves. It's I think DRS that came out in 2012 and our studio founded in 2012, and you can probably see a few similarities to our first work before we were finding our voice to DRS there. So yeah, huge inspiration. Our studio wouldn't exist without you. So thank you very much for your time today, Dan.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
These are the types of conversations that fascinate me, and I really hope they help with your own work. If you have any questions or topics you'd like me to cover, please do reach out at pete.bottomley@whitepapergames.com. That's pete.bottomley@whitepapergames.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please consider subscribing on your preferred platform to stay up to date with each episode we release. And until next time, thank you.